You're listening to Midoriha's first broadcast on the 7th of February 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midoriha's on Monocle 24 live from Studio One in London with me, Markus Hippi. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, the political leaders of Palestine's Gaza and the West Bank meet to discuss forming a national unity government in Cairo. We have the latest.
They're going to form some sort of committee that will demonstrate that they are working, in fact, towards this mythical reconciliation. But it doesn't appear that anything concrete will come of this.
And China encourages the West to invest in its once wild West. The nation's richest city gets a British leisure makeover. Plus, we find out why one Malian music festival has won an award for freedom of musical expression. All that plus more, all to come in the next hour here on Midori House. But first, let's catch up on the headlines with Jonathan Wheatley.
Tunisia's governing Islamists have today rebuffed a plan by their party chief and prime minister to replace the government after unrest erupted over the killing of an opposition leader, deepening the worst crisis since the country's revolution in 2011. Turmoil in the North African state that spawned the Arab Spring uprisings flared anew, with protesters setting ablaze the local headquarters of the main Islamist Ennahda party and a police station in the provincial town of Kelibia. Police fired tear gas to scatter protesters near the Interior Ministry in Tunis, and stone-throwing youths in the southern mining town of Gafsa, where at least seven people there were injured. Crowds ransacked electronics shops in Sfax. Human Rights Watch have today said in a new report that India needs to protect its children from sexual abuse at a time when the country was struggling to come out from the trauma of the violent gang rape and murder of a woman in New Delhi. Meenakshi Ganguly is Human Rights Watch's South Asia director.
There is a lot of attention right now on sexual violence. We need to focus on the abuse of children. We need the government not just to legislate. We need the government to amend and to ensure that these policies, some of them are good policies, but they need to be properly implemented at every level.
European Union leaders arrived in Brussels today for 2 days of negotiations over the bloc's 2014 to 2020 budget, which will assign nearly 1 trillion euros of spending and will pit the EU's more fiscally conservative northern countries against those from the south who want money for infrastructure and agriculture. The British Prime Minister David Cameron said he would block an agreement unless there is a sufficient cut in spending, although he didn't specify to what level.
Frankly, the European Union should not be immune from the sorts of pressures that we've had to reduce spending, find efficiencies, and make sure that we spend money wisely that we're all having to do right across Europe. Now, when we were last here in November, the numbers that were put forward were much too high. They need to come down, and if they don't come down, there won't be a deal.
Elsewhere in Brussels, over 7,000 civil servants took to the streets of the Belgian capital to protest against the government's policy of natural attrition, not filling jobs freed up when employees retire. Belgian media reported nationwide strikes, with prison guards and policemen being among those to walk out. The US Vice President Joe Biden has urged fellow Democrats in the House of Representatives to comply with public demands for action to reduce gun violence. It's unclear which, if any, of Biden's gun control recommendations Congress might approve, but the Vice President said legislators have an obligation to do as much as they can.
Is it acceptable to say we just have to have a narrow focus, deal with only those things we can have an overwhelming consensus on? Leave the more controversial elements of gun safety aside. But I can't imagine how we will be judged as individuals, judged as the Congress, judged as a nation, if we do nothing. It's simply unacceptable.
And finally, the Canadian novelist Lisa Gabrielle never felt she was especially good at writing sex scenes. But when an editor dared her to write an erotic novel to rival the widely popular global hit 50 Shades of Grey, well, she took up the challenge. A week later, she had some 40 pages written on Secret, the just-published story of an underground society that helps women realise their wildest sexual dreams. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Jonathan, and we will have the next news headlines here on Monocle 24 in about 25 minutes. It is 18.05 in London, 13.05 in Washington, D.C. You are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. You are listening to Midori House, live from Studio One in London, and today we start in Cairo, where the political leaders of Palestine's Gaza and the West Bank have been meeting to discuss forming a national unity government, and some agreement was reached yesterday. The rival Palestinian factions of Hamas and Fatah agreed to form a new committee to help reconciliation attempts. Monocle's correspondent Joseph Dana is now in Cairo to give us the latest. Hello, Joseph, and thank you for joining Midori House. First of all, this new committee should help kickstart reconciliation attempts. How much can we actually expect?
Well, good evening. You know, this issue of Palestinian reconciliation has become a kind of evergreen issue when it comes to Palestinian politics. And the rival factions, Hamas and Fatah, very much understand that time is running out. Palestinians have become very disillusioned with this really kind of ongoing process. It's been upwards of 5 years now that they've been kind of wrangling about reconciliation. And so now, yesterday, they announced that they're going to form a new committee that will be tasked with trying to accelerate this process. Whether or not this committee is going to actually be successful is very much kind of up for grabs. You know, there's a lot of kind of internal wrangling about how the PLO, this is the kind of the new catchphrase that's been coming out, how the PLO is going to be reformed, if there's going to be some sort of new Palestinian elections about the PLO. And so it's really a signal that that both Fatah and Hamas understand that time is running out, as I noted, and that they're losing kind of the streets. And so I think a lot of Palestinians tonight are not so hopeful that anything of, you know, concrete will come out of this new negotiation.
Could you imagine, what exactly could you imagine this committee doing in reality?
Well, that's a very good question. And I think this is exactly the question that a lot of Palestinians are asking themselves is, you know, okay, so the issues are very clear. There has been an incredible divide inside of the Palestinian political spectrum. And so maybe not, a new committee might not be the right course of action. And the right course of action should be some really concrete measures bringing Gaza and the West Bank leadership, together. Again, it doesn't appear as though anything concrete has come out of these meetings. There's no, you know, step in which they said we are going to meet in Ramallah, we're going to meet in Gaza City, and something of great consequence will come out of this. So it's really anyone's guess as to what this new committee is actually going to do.
Could you see the Middle East peace process getting any further without some sort of reconciliation between Fatah and Hamas?
Well, unfortunately not. I mean, the divided nature of Palestinian politics has really kind of coincided with this incredible stalemate that we have between Israel and the Palestinians. Gaza and the West Bank have never been so divided in their history. You know, Abbas sits in Ramallah, and the Hamas leadership is sitting in Gaza City, and they seem to be moving in different directions. Although, you know, last couple of months, there were some concrete signs as to moving closer. There was some Hamas rallies in the West Bank, and Hamas invited Fatah participants to their rallies in Gaza. And so, it's anyone's guess as to how this committee is going to actually do anything. But it is an absolutely crucial element of the Middle East peace process that the Palestinians are united as opposed to being divided.
Well, another interesting piece of news from Cairo is that President Mahmoud Abbas actually had some sort of greetings for Iran's President Ahmadinejad.
Indeed, this was really a kind of boisterous statement that Abbas reportedly made to Ahmadinejad, in which he said, listen, we are working towards a Palestinian state. This is a priority of the Fatah-led Palestinian Authority. We went to the United Nations. We got recognition for the state, and this is the priority. And so if you would like to support the Palestinian cause, it's best to support our state-building procedure as opposed to, you know, making these very kind of verbose statements about wiping Israel off the map. The Iranians haven't really responded publicly to these comments that Abbas had made, but it is significant that Abbas is taking that initiative and kind of, you know, going to regional powers and saying this is what we need in order to kickstart something on the ground, as opposed to, again, this kind of verbose rhetoric.
Do you think President Ahmadinejad would actually do what has been asked?
It's a very good question. I mean, the Palestinian issue has always been a kind of political football in the Middle East. We saw this very much with the last Gaza war, in which the Egyptian president, Mohamed Morsi, kind of reasserted his regional power by brokering a truce between Hamas and Israel. And so, you know, whether or not Ahmadinejad's, you know, intentions are really to help the Palestinian people or to forward his own political program remains to be seen. But it does kind of bode well that Abbas is kind of stepping up to Abbas stepping up to Ahmadinejad and telling him exactly what he believes the Palestinians require.
Yet another announcement. The U.S. President Obama is going to get more involved by visiting both Israel and Palestine in March. Once again, how significant is that?
Well, it's very significant insofar as President Obama has never visited Israel or Palestine during his administration. And so this is a sign that the Americans understand the importance of the Palestinian-Israeli issue and that they are actually going to kind of send the highest level representatives to the region. Now, the Palestinians have greeted this announcement that Obama is planning to arrive in Israel and Palestine with kind of reticence. They believe that Obama has not done enough in pressuring the Israelis to stop settlement activity and to kind of kickstart this very stagnant peace process. And so they're kind of greeting this news with a bit of reticence and establishing the fact that what is needed is real significant pressure on the Israelis to kickstart this peace process. And so how Obama is going to do this will be very, very interesting to see unfold in March when he's expected to arrive.
Joseph Dana in Cairo, thank you again for your time. And coming up, the once Wild West of China, the new frontier for Western investment. Rafael Pantucci of the Royal United Services Institute joins us after the break.
Inspirational mayors, money-making gentrifiers, park creators, subway planners, tech hub upstarts, wayfinding geniuses, broom-toting road sweepers, stadium designers, all-seeing historians, and squawking birds. But they help make a city. You'll meet them on The Urbanist, Monocle's weekly show about the cities we live in that's presented by me, Andrew Tuck.
That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Sichuan was one of China's poorest provinces until investment from Beijing and abroad brought boom time to its capital. Monocle's video journalist Gabriel Li paid a visit to Chengdu to gauge the progress.
Here the changes are radical. This has become a much more international city, and every day you see it growing more and more. This is the new market inside of China, which is it's not a market itself, it's a continent. Foreign companies that want to sell something in China, now they're trying to come here. And you can see they're coming here.
Chengdu, the new China, in the films menu on monocle.com.
14 minutes past the top of the hour. You are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. The once wild expanses of Western China are no longer the final frontier. After years of the nation's Go West campaign to develop the region, which is sparsely populated but extremely resource-rich, it seems the foreign companies are indeed heading west. The latest development is an announcement by British engineering agency Atkins. It has been commissioned to design the new Donghu Central Leisure Area in the city of Karame. And to tell us more, I'm joined in the studio by Raffaella Pantucci, Senior Research Fellow at Royal United Services Institute. Hello and welcome to Midori House.
Hi Marcus, thank you.
How significant is this deal that has now been made, a British company going there?
Well, I mean, this deal in a way is one of a number of deals we've seen of foreign companies coming into the province. Within this particular city, it's quite fascinating because this particular city is such an odd place.
What kind of place is it?
Well, this is the thing. It's this city that no one's ever heard of, and yet it's got the richest per GDP, per head, per capita GDP in the entire country. It's a city of 400,000 people. It's because it sits in the middle of China's sort of oil fields up in the north that have been developed. And the actual city, I've driven through it, unfortunately, once, quite briefly, but it's a very modern place. You know, it's brand new. Last year, they partnered with IBM, the company, to develop a smart city program, which basically means they have sort of wireless everywhere to try to use cloud computing to basically connect up the whole city. And now you got Atkins that's building this giant leisure center in the middle of the city. You know, so it's kind of extraordinary that you got this little city scattered out in a part of China that no one goes to, that is attracting all this foreign investment. You know, more broadly, I think this is an interesting example of the effort that the government is really putting in to try to get foreign companies in particular drawn into this province.
Why does China want foreign investment so much?
Well, I mean, there are reasons for it. This province has been the focus of a lot of attention for many years. Back in July 2009, you may remember there's some very very nasty riots in Urumqi, the provincial capital, in which about 200 people were killed. And these riots sort of at their root had this ethnic tension that you've always had in the province. You have a minority population of Uyghurs who see themselves as oppressed by the Han majority and feel like their land is being taken away from them. They're nothing like Han Chinese. I mean, they look Turkish. They speak a language that's sort of Turkic homonym. And so this has been the root of a lot of tensions. And this blew up in particular in July 2009. So the government thought, well, okay, the solution to this is to attract a lot of investment into the province. Now, they've got a lot of money within the country that you put in that direction. But if you bring outside companies in, then you're bringing international attention, international focus, and it will make it maybe more sustainable. Because, you know, Chinese companies have their own issues and problems in terms of corruption, in terms of, you know, in terms of management styles and sort of approaches to business that may not actually have the net result of increasing economic development in the province. A lot of these companies, there is a very big company called the Xinjiang Production and Construction Corp that basically controls a lot of the economy in the province. So the government is sort of trying to break this by bringing in outside companies.
Could it not also be argued that when there is more foreign investment, more international attention, at the same time more international attention to the problems in that area, say, about human rights?
Yeah. Yes, I mean, this is the dilemma about human rights in this province is a very difficult one. But I don't think from a sort of foreign company perspective, it's in a way any different to investing in another province in China. Ultimately, it's the same government that controls the whole country. It's just in this one province you have this particular sort of problem. But what's interesting is the Chinese government is trying to be proactive. And they've been one particular country that they've targeted. I mean, here we highlight Britain and the UK, the Confederation of British Industry and the China-Britain Business Council do a lot of work out in Xinjiang. But they've been courting very actively the Turkish government. Because, of course, Turks, as I said before, they have this linguistic proximity to Uyghurs. A lot of Uyghurs go to Turkey when they go abroad. And so they've been trying to get the Turkish government in particular very interested. And they've signed a number of deals and agreements. And they built a big trade park just outside Urumqi, which is specifically trying to get Turkish companies to come and invest in the province.
So considering how resource-rich the west of China is, why has it taken so long, years, to try to attract foreign investment? And why is it really only happening now?
Well, The company I mentioned before, the XPCC, the Xinjiang Production Construction Corps. I'm going to give you a very short history of it quickly now, and I'll be brief. The company was originally born out of basically demobilized PLA soldiers who were first back in 1949 when sort of China was all coming together, you know, and the PLA was sort of stretching out as far as there. They demobbed a lot of soldiers and left them behind to create this company called the XPCC that basically controls the entire region's economy. So this company's had a sort of control over the economy in parallel with the sort of local government structures. And they've maybe been stifling it in some ways. So it's been difficult for others to come in. Now there's this conscious effort to try to get foreign investment in.
And considering what has now been seen in the region, how much further investment could you see happening there in the future?
I mean, the sky's the limit in many ways, you know? I mean, you've got... I don't know the exact figures, but if I recall, it's almost a third of China's oil, onshore oil and gas are in the province. I think 40% of it's coal, and a lot of that hasn't been exploited yet. The region is adjacent to Central Asia and Afghanistan, which at the moment are sort of politically unstable countries and have their issues and difficulties. However, they're big potential markets. If we go through them, we go on to Russia and Europe, which are other giant markets for China. So there's a lot of potential here. In this province, economically, both in investing in the province, but also in investing in this look west strategy that the Chinese have approached, which looks beyond China's borders, but into its broader western region.
And are we going to see China doing even more to attract foreign investment there?
Yes, I think we can definitively say that we are. They have this big thing called the China Eurasia Expo that they just had the second one this September. They're doing another one next September. And these are these giant roadshows where they basically try to bring in lots of foreign businesses. I was very lucky and went to the one last September, and they had Premier Wen Jiabao gave a presentation. The governor of the province gave a presentation. Tony Blair was there and gave a presentation.
Okay, then.
So, you know, this is a big push they're doing, and I think we're going to just see it grow more and more.
Rafael Pantucci, thank you, as always, for your insights.
Thank you.
And if you are still suffering from an Olympics hangover, India might just have the cure. India's rural Olympics. Events include getting run over by a tractor, carrying a bicycle in your teeth, and standing on top of two horses as they gallop down a field. The event has taken place every year since 1933 and now attracts more than 4,000 men and women. Native Punjabi journalist and rural Olympic aficionado Rahul Bedi explained to our foreign editor Steve Bloom field what to expect from this year's event.
Firstly, let me give you a bit of history. This village in which they take place is a village called Kila Raipur. It's in my home state of Punjab, and it's the Olympics are organized by the Garhwal clan. They belong to this region, and they're a very gregarious and a very outgoing and very noisy lot of people, and they've organized these Olympics, as you said, since 1933. And they consist of disciplines like tag and chase, cycling, ram fighting, bull, camel, and dog racing. But these are, of course, the more civilized sport, because a lot of others include pulling tractors with your teeth, lifting massive bullet cart wheels, and bending thick iron rods like the strong men in villages of old around their necks.
And how popular have the games become now? Because obviously, that, you know, they've been going for, you know, 77 years. Have they become a truly national event?
Well, they're not a national event. Actually, they're a local event, and only local teams participate. Mostly, the clan, as I said, is a Sikh clan. There are Sikhs who wear turbans. They are the only ones that participate in it. And the finale to the whole Olympics is a 300-meter bullock cart race in which bulls are high on liquor and opium, and they participate in this run because there's a huge amount of betting that goes on also.
Sorry, hang on. Sorry, the bulls are high on opium and rum?
The bulls are high on a mixture of opium, rum, and local moonshine.
Is that legal?
Well, strictly speaking, it's not, because animal rights activists have come down on them. But it's very difficult to tell these people from this village because they're extremely aggressive and they've been doing it for the last 70 odd years. So nobody really interferes with them very much.
Right. Okay. And I guess like all Olympics, there's a corporate side to this now. You know, big car companies, Nokia sponsors some of it as well. Has that, like, you know, as with the other Olympics, sort of taken some of the fun out of it by having all these corporates involved?
Well, it's become less fun and more competitive, as it were. Because a few years ago when I attended, you know, the trophies in this largely agricultural area were farming implements, fertilizer bags and seeds, you know, that kind of thing, because they were used in the villages. But now, as you said, the corporates have moved in, so more money has come in, and therefore it's become a little more venal.
But does it still try to keep its original heart and soul?
Oh, very much so. And in fact, I must mention that one of the star attractions in this is a hockey tournament, because a lot of the hockey players in India traditionally came from the state of Punjab. And the prize for this is a gold cup, a solid gold cup, which was donated by a member of the Garhwal clan who lives in Kenya sometime in the 60s.
Rahul Berry there talking to Steve Bloomfield. And if that didn't transport you to the Punjab, this just might. Here is Asa Singh Mastana and Baleni Punjab D. Punjabi maestro Asa Singh Mastana and Baleni Punjab D. There you are listening to Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
In the next half hour of the program, we head to the skies to assess Brazil's regional aviation upgrade. We hear how one music festival continues despite the ongoing Malian conflict, and we find out what to look forward to in this year's Berlin Film Festival.
The unique thing about Berlin is audience. Last year, we purchased something like 500,000 tickets in these 10 days, and I think rarely any other festival in the world has this strong attendance by just people, you know.
But first, here is Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines.
Marcus, thanks very much. Tunisia's governing Islamists have today rebuffed a plan by their party chief and prime minister to replace the government after unrest erupted over the killing of an opposition leader, deepening the worst crisis since the country's revolution in 2011. Human Rights Watch have today said in a new report that India needs to protect its children from sexual abuse at a time when the country was struggling to come out from the trauma of the violent gang rape and murder of a woman in New Delhi. European Union leaders arrived in Brussels today for 2 days of negotiations over the bloc's 2014 to 2020 budget, which will assign nearly 1 trillion euros of spending and will pit the EU's more fiscally conservative northern countries against those from the south who want more money for infrastructure and agriculture. Elsewhere in Brussels, over 7,000 civil servants took to the streets of the Belgian capital to protest against the government's policy of natural attrition, which is not filling up jobs freed up when employees retire. And the US Vice President Joe Biden has urged fellow Democrats in the House of Representatives to comply with public demands for action to reduce gun violence. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
You are back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Markus Hippi. It is 18:31 in London and 10:31 a.m. in San Francisco. Now, when you are hosting both the upcoming Football World Cup and the next Olympic Games and are well on the way to becoming one of the world's economic heavy hitters, it helps to have a travel infrastructure that can tend to the locals and host the guests. Cue Brazil announcing a mega nationwide investment program of nearly $4 billion into improving its aviation network of airport hubs and airline routes. Tristan McAllister, our transport editor, joins us on the line from his own travels. He is in Toronto now. Welcome to Midori House, Tristan.
Good evening, Marcus.
Good evening. So where exactly will this almost $4 billion be spent?
Well, it's part of a bigger plan, Marcus, that was announced earlier in 2012 that
encompassed rail and road sectors. And now the government has gone on to say that they essentially want to spend 4.6 billion U.S. dollars, that's 2.8 billion euros, on internal airport infrastructure. And they're really focusing on the regional airports at this point. What they're saying is that initially 270 of those regional airports will be taken care of or upgraded. And then ultimately it will move on to all 689 civil aviation airports. So it's a very, very big spend. It seems somewhat aggressive. And it's obviously very good news for the Brazilian economy as they're getting ready for, as you mentioned earlier, the World Cup and the Olympics.
Do you think this money will be enough, after all, considering the state where Brazil's aviation infrastructure is in at that moment?
I think, you know, Marcus, when you look at the situation in Brazil and how it's been for years and how it's been really hard for carriers traditionally to start there and how big ones have come up and then failed, the infrastructure there was just not made for this. And so any spend is going to be a good spend. And they are, you know, that's a significant amount of money. And they have an emerging middle class, and those are all things that play into Brazil becoming a world power and an economic player internationally. So when you look at this and you look at these airports that need it, you look at an airline, take for example Azul. That's a new startup carrier in Brazil. It was founded by the JetBlue founder in the United States, Dave Neilman. He left his post, or was forced out of his post at JetBlue, and went down to Brazil and said, I see a real opportunity here because there's an emerging middle class. You have all these airports with not so great infrastructure, but tons of potential. So he really got to it and said, you know, it's time to think about regional players. It's time to create an airline for the people, and he did it. Very successful, and I think that in some ways that became a sign to the government there that they could do this and that the infrastructure was needed because the demand was there, and that's what you're seeing. So in someone like Dave Neilman's head, who I spoke to a few months ago regarding this, he says, of course, it's time to do this. Let's do it.
So you can basically see this as a signal of self-confidence in Brazil as well.
I think in many ways, yes. And it's clearly a soft power play in terms, you know, if you want to put it in Monocle terms, we, you know, talk about the idea of real brand development and really being able to play on a world stage.
And just to get to practical levels, you know, let's think about Olympic Games. Let's think about the World Cup that's coming up. After all this money has been spent, how is the customer experience going to be different when, you know, someone from abroad goes to Brazil?
And I think that's a good point, and that remains to be seen. At this point, there really is, you know, there's one major international Brazilian carrier. It's called TAM, and they don't necessarily, when you look at the airplane, you don't think Brazil as you would with, say, like Air France, or you would with British Airways, or even American Airlines. So it doesn't necessarily represent a national brand to the world. And in terms of service and brand, that's something that they're really going to need to work on if they want to play with the big international players in the airline industry overall. But, you know, there is hope here, and they are looking in the right direction, it seems. And this investment will really put the discussion in the right place and say Brazil is starting to get serious about air travel.
And what do we know about the schedule, you know, how all this money is going to be spent? By the time of these big events, World Cup and Olympic Games, will everything be ready?
I think it's really hard to say it will be by the time that happens. You know, I didn't necessarily see any timeline in a lot of this, which, you know, might be scary. But I think with a lot of these infrastructure projects, they happen gradually. They happen as they should. I think they focus where they need to first. As I said, 270 are going to get the initial sort of bump. And then beyond that, they'll expand it to all the airports. So I think they'll be somewhat strategic about it. But in that strategy is probably a reluctance to talk about real hard dates.
Tristan McAllister, Transport Editor in Toronto, many thanks for your time. And staying in Canada, music by Tekken and Zara next. They are in London right now, actually promoting their new album Heartthrob. And this is a track from that very same album, played right here in Midori House. This is Back in Your Head.
Between us in my bed, repeat, repeat. much better, no, we both said. Relax into the knee, we get so comfortable. Remember when I was so stringent like a bull? Holding hands with you. Well, I know these habits hurt important parts of you. Remember when I was sweet and unexplainable. I'm nothing like this person unlovable.
That was Tegan and Sarah Ann Back in Your Head, recorded here in Midori House. And you are listening to Midori House. We head next to Germany, where today marks the start of the 63rd Berlin Film Festival. Stay tuned.
If we use, dear listeners, the metaphor of Monocle 24 as an online radio amusement park, then Culture with me, Robert Bound, is the roller coaster.
We are finally on the train, on the sexy contemporary art train.
Scaling the heights of artistic endeavour to look out across a picturesque international landscape dotted with galleries, live music venues, outdoor screenings of wonderful movies being scrutinised and applauded by appreciative audiences. Marvel at the view. Strap yourself in. Scream, ladies and gentlemen, if you want to go faster. We're just one metaphor away from a meltdown. On the latest edition, we send Katie to Cannes to catch up with the music industry's movers and shakers, visit Miami to see what kind of TV the big boys are buying, and get down to a seriously freestyle Midori House session from jazz hip-hop maestro Soweto Kinch, who talks a good game too.
A particular kind of energy spark happened between an audience and you while you're freestyling. You can't deny that it's some kind of spiritual energy that moves, that makes it work or not work sometimes.
That's Culture with Robert Bound, premiering every Monday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Wake up in Asia or sip a nightcap in Europe to the Monocle Daily, with 2 hours of analysis and reports on current affairs, culture, and business. Hear from experts, authors, and editors of far-flung newspapers, as well as our own correspondents, every weekday at 2200 hours London time.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Markus Hippi. Today marks the first day of the 63rd Berlin Film Festival. The festival is well known for its political topics and is perhaps focused less on the mainstream fare so coveted by Cannes or the Oscars. This year is no different, with timely topics such as the global financial crisis and environmental issues on the front line for Berlin's audiences. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco caught up with the festival program manager Thomas Heiler.
How political can Berlin Festival be?
I mean, the Berlin Film Festival is a political invention. It was founded back in the 50s by the U.S. Administration in post-war Berlin, in order to teach the Berliners, the post-Nazi Berlin society, to teach them diversity and to teach them how to handle different issues and different points of view from the world. So from the cradle, the Berlin Film Festival has been a political affair, and I think we stuck with it during all the years.
Well, and that's what makes the festival special as well. And going through a couple of issues, for example, there's the new Soderbergh film, which is about pharmaceutical companies as well. What other serious topics are there on the competition?
I mean, in general, the competition, we see quite a couple of films where people, individual people, have to deal with the aftermath of the financial crisis, of the money crisis, and we see these people struggle against their reality, which isn't too good. But it's not about criticizing general political issues. It's more about watching people handling their and following their challenges.
Is the focus on the festival more on European films, or do you think the festival is becoming more and more global?
Has always been an international festival, not with a special European appeal. But of course, I mean, we're on a great film market parallel to the festival, and so there is lots of European input and content. But we are proud to present films from all five continents.
Any country in special that managed to grab the spotlight this year? I noticed that you've been looking quite far east this year, right?
Because of from our point of view, it's more close east. It's Eastern Europe, Central Europe. So we have a number of films coming from Romania, from Poland, from Russia, from Kazakhstan. So looking east from Berlin, and there we have some very strong and edgy independent voices.
If you would compare, let's say, Berlin Film Festival with other important film festivals in the world, like the Cannes Festival, what would you say that makes the difference?
I mean, the unique thing about Berlin is audience. Last year we purchased something like 500,000 tickets in these 10 days, and I think rarely any other festival in the world has this strong attendance by just people, you know, cinemaniacs, people who really queue for hours and do everything to get a ticket to see one of the world premieres running in the festival.
And just out of curiosity, which film was chosen to open the Berlinale this year?
Tonight we are going to screen The Grandmaster, the new film by Wong Kar-wai.
Oh, fantastic. And what is the story of the film?
It is the story about the end of an era of the grandmasters of martial arts who, in a way, meet by the mid of the last century, who meet to find out who is entitled to call himself a grandmaster. And one of the combatants is Ip Man, who in later times became the teacher of Bruce Lee.
I was just wondering if there's any of the films that are out of the main competition that caught your eye.
Plenty of them. If I would have time and if I wouldn't work here, I would definitely go and see The Act of Killing, a documentary by Josh Oppenheimer, which is telling in a very strong way about the political murders in Indonesia back in the 60s. And this is a piece of documentary. I've never seen something like this.
Well,
another very nice thing in the forum will be Isabella Rossellini will present the follow-up project to her Green Porno. This time she's presenting self-directed, self-produced a little spots about mammals, and she will be present at the performance, and she will add a live performance to this one as well. So that's going to be exciting as well.
That was the festival program manager of the 63rd Berlin Film Festival, Thomas Heiler, speaking to Monocle's researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco. You are listening to Midori House, and the time is 18:47 here in London, 13:47 in New York City. The power of music to give a voice to the suppressed, be it Stravinsky's works at the turn of the 20th century in Russia, or expressing the anger of a generation with punk rock in the 80s in the UK, is well documented. The Free Muse Award, sponsored by the Björn Afzelius International Culture Foundation, recognizes artists and organizations that are doing just that. Celebrating the freedom of musical expression against the odds. Mali's own Festival in the Desert is to be awarded the prize for 2013. The festival went into exile last year due to threats from Islamist militants. Co-founder of Free Muse, Ole Raitov, joins us on the line now. Ole, welcome to the show. So, this festival in the Desert, went into exile last year. Do you know how the organizers are doing now and what their plans are?
Well, they had a plan to do a spring caravan, but they had to cancel it just a couple of weeks ago because of the security situation. So they're planning now for the autumn. They hope to do a festival as a caravan in Africa and seemingly also in Northern Europe. So that's the plans right now.
If we look at the history of this award, the prize, what kind of winners have you had with the Free Muse during the previous years?
Well, the first winner was the African reggae artist Tegan Jah Fakoly, who about 5 years ago made a song which criticized the government of his country for not living up to the promises, and he got in very big problem and was threatened to death. So he actually, and this is the irony of it, he went into exile in the then very safe Mali. And we've had Pete Seeger, as many people will know, as the old champion of protest songs, who was very strong in the civil rights movement in the U.S. We've had Ferhat Tunç from Turkey. And last year we gave it to Rami Issam, who became the voice of the revolution at the Tahrir Square in Egypt 2 years ago.
And after years of awarding individuals, you have awarded now an organization with the Free Muse Award. Why that?
Because the signal they have sent, we believe, is very important to defend freedom of musical expression, in spite of all the horrors that they experienced, not only when the terrorists actually took most of the northern Mali, but even before that, they had several threats, but somehow they had a way of negotiating and they could keep going on. But when that was not possible anymore, they went into exile and said, we'll continue, we'll never give up, because music is such an essential part of life in Mali.
And what do you actually wish to achieve through the means of this Free Muse Prize?
There are two things we hope to accomplish. One thing, that by giving an award for freedom of musical expression, we put an alert out that it's still a big problem that music is being persecuted in many countries. The other thing is, of course, to support and stimulate people or organizations who have stood up for freedom of musical expression. So these are the two things we're basically trying to accomplish.
So when it comes to, you know, getting the international attention as well in, you know, these certain regions around the world, you know, to see the people and the organizations that are struggling with their music because of censorship and other problems, who other people or organizations would you like to mention in specific? Were there other people, organizations shortlisted for this year's prize?
Well, there was actually consensus about the prize. Of course, there has a lot of things has happened in the past years. Pussy Riot, of course, is known to everyone. Two of the members are still in prison. It's very difficult to work for the other members in Russia. But somehow we felt that it's important to send a signal to this organization in Africa, because it has a very symbolic meaning, not only for Mali, but for the whole of Africa. But there are a lot of brave people out there. Fortunately, there are also some good stories. Some of the decisions that we have made actions to get out of prisons are now out of prison, but not just because of our work. Of course, the developments in Burma, for instance, have been very positive in that sense. But really, we're talking about the tip of the iceberg, because there are so many various mechanisms of how you can repress artistic freedom of expression around the world. And the interesting thing is that this year actually is the first time that the UN put a focus on it through the UN Special Rapporteur on Cultural Rights. So we believe that after working 14 years in this field and constantly trying to say there is a big problem, not only for musicians but for other artists as well, finally it seems that, if you could use the term, the world community is waking up.
At the same time, do you see new challenges arising?
There are a lot of challenges, because many constitutions in principle guarantee freedom of artistic expression. Well, when you look into it and the implementation of it, it's much more varied image, and you have countries which claim that we have absolutely, completely artistic freedom, but when you look into the regulations done by police or by other authorities or broadcasters, the picture looks very, very different. So what you have to do is, on one level, raise consciousness about these issues, on the other level, that artists themselves, together with human rights activists and lawyers, actually challenge those states who continue to repress the artists.
It sounds like there is still a lot of work to be done. Ole Reithov, thank you so much for joining us on the show. That's all we have time for today. Thanks to our great team, producer Ala John, our researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager Ben Jay. Next is an urbanist special on gentrification. David Michaud will be filling in for Andrew Tuck and taking us around the globe to see how the controversial process is affecting our cities. In 3 hours' time, at 2200 hours here in London, me and Phil Hahn will be back for the Monocle Daily, and I will also be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But for now, playing us out is one of the groups featuring in the festival of the dessert. Here is Koite by Wari Habib. From me, for now, goodbye.